and the darkness closed around Teo with an ambush of voices in English and Japanese. He clenched his hands around the bottle until he felt a sharp snap. It was too late then. It tore loose. The little Japanese boy was smiling in the L.A. depot. Darkness came like night fog, and someone was bending over a small body. Teo jumped up from the table, panting. The sweat ran down his face like tears. "Killer!" he screamed. "Killer!" The others were quiet, but Emo started laughing. His voice echoed around the room. "You drink like an Indian, and you're crazy like one, too, but you aren't shit, white trash. You love the Japs the way your mother loved to screw white men." Emo's shirt had dark circles of sweat under each arm. Teo watched his belly and the way the shirt stuck to it with sweat. He watched the belly quiver when Emo laughed at him. He moved suddenly, with speed which was effortless and floating like a mountain lion. He got stronger with every jerk that Emo made, and he felt that he would get well if he killed him. But they wouldn't let him do it. They grabbed his arms and pulled his hands out of Emo's belly. He saw their mouths open, yelling, but he didn't hear them, and the snow tumbled over him. The silence was dense. The darkness was cold. When the cops came, he was still gripping the broken bottle in his hand and watching his own blood flow between the fingers of his fist and drip on the Mexican's oiled wood floor. He stood still. Only his brain was moving. The haze from the beer was gone, like heat and dust washed out of the sky by a summer rain. He should have hated Emo. He should have hated the Jap soldiers who killed Rocky. The space to carry hate was located deep inside, below his lungs and behind his belly. But it was empty. He watched while they knelt over Emo and then loaded him into the ambulance. His hand didn't hurt either. The blood felt like warm water trickling down his fingers. He didn't feel anything. The cops made him show them the hand. They wrapped it tight with a big roll of gauze and handcuffed him. He dozed in the back seat of the police car all the way to Albuquerque. He knew what his eyes had seen and what his ears had heard. He knew what he felt in his belly and up and down his backbone. But he wasn't sure anymore what to believe or whom he could trust. He wasn't sure. The army recruiter had taped posters of tanks and marching soldiers around the edge of a folding table. The government car was parked next to the post office under the flagpole, and he had set up the table next to the car, trying to find shelter from the wind. But the posters were flapping and twisting around, and the brittle edges of the paper were beginning to split and tear. There was a chill in the wind during the last days. The sun occupied a summer place in the sky, and something relentless in the way the wind drove the sand and dust ahead of it. The recruiter was sitting on his folding chair, but he had to keep both hands on his pamphlets to keep them from scattering. He'd been waiting for more people to show up before he began his speech, but Rocky and Teo and old man Jeff were the only people out in the wind that afternoon. "Anyone can fight for America," he began, giving special emphasis to America. "Even you boys. In a time of need, anyone can fight for her." A big gust of sand swirled around them. Rocky turned his back to it, and Teo covered his face with his hands. Old man Jeff went inside the post office. The recruiter paused to rearrange the pamphlets and check the damage the wind had done to the posters. He looked disgusted then, as though he were almost ready to leave, but he went on with his speech. "Now, I know you boys love America as much as we do. This is your big chance to show it." He stood up then, as he had rehearsed, and looked them in the eye sincerely. He handed them color pamphlets with a man in a khaki uniform and gold braid on the cover. In the background, behind the figure in the uniform, there was a gold eagle with its wings spread across an American flag. Rocky read each page of the pamphlet carefully. He looked up at Teo, and his face was serious and proud. Teo knew right then what Rocky wanted to do. The wind blew harder. A gust caught the pamphlets and swirled them off the card table. They scattered like dry leaves across the ground. The recruiter ran after them with his arms out in front of him as if he were chasing turkeys. Rocky helped him pick them up, and he nodded sharply for Teo to help, too. Rocky talked to the recruiter about the training programs while they shook sand out of the brochures and folded them up again. I want to be a pilot. He paused and looked at the recruiter. You can fly all over the world that way, can't you? The recruiter was packing the leaflets into a cardboard box. He didn't look up. Sure, sure, he said. You enlist now and you'll be eligible for everything. Pilot training, everything. He folded the legs under the little table and slammed down the lid of the car's trunk. He glanced at his big chrome wristwatch. You men want to sign up? Rocky looked at Teo as if he wanted to ask him something. It was strange to see that expression on his face, because Rocky had always known what he was doing without asking anyone. And my brother, Rocky said, nodding at Teo. If we both sign up, can we stay together? It was the first time in all the years that Teo had lived with him that Rocky ever called him brother. Auntie had always been careful that Rocky didn't call Teo brother. And when other people mistakenly called them brothers, she was quick to correct the error. They're not brothers, she'd say. That's Laura's boy, you know the one. She had a way of saying it, a tone of voice which bitterly told the story and the disgrace she and the family had suffered. The things Laura had done weren't easily forgotten by the people, but she could maintain a distance between Rocky, who was her pride, and this other unwanted child. If nobody else ever knew about this distance, she and Teo did. He was 4 years old the night his mother left him there. He didn't remember much, only that she had come after dark and wrapped him in a man's coat. It smelled like a man. And that there were men in the car with them. And she held him all the way, kept him bundled tight and close to her. And he had dozed and listened, half dreaming their laughter and the sound of a cork squeaking in and out of a bottle. He couldn't remember if she had fed him, but when they got to Laguna that night, he wasn't hungry, and he refused the bread Uncle Josiah offered him. He clung to her because when she left him, he knew she would be gone for a long time. She kissed him on the forehead with whiskey breath, and then pushed him gently into Josiah's arms as she backed out the door. He cried and fought Josiah, trying to follow her, but his uncle held him firmly and told him not to cry because he had a brother now. Rocky would be his brother, and he could stay with him until Christmas. Rocky had been staring at him, but with the mention of Christmas he started crying and kicking the leg of the table. There were tears all over his face, and his nose was running. "Go away," he screamed. "You're not my brother. I don't want no brother." Teo covered his ears with his hands and buried his face against Josiah's leg, crying because he knew. This time she wasn't coming back for him. Josiah pulled out his red bandana handkerchief and wiped Teo's nose and eyes. He looked at Rocky sternly and then took both of the little boys by the hand. They walked into the back room together, and Josiah showed them the bed that he and Rocky would share for so many years. When old Grandma and Auntie came home that night from the bingo game at the church, Teo and Rocky were already in bed. Teo could tell by the sound of his breathing that Rocky was already asleep. But he lay there in the dark and listened to the voices in the kitchen, voices of Josiah and Auntie and the faint voice of old Grandma. He never knew what they said that night because the voices merged into a hum, like night insects around a lamp. But he thought he could hear Auntie raise her voice and the sound of pots and pans slamming together on the stove. And years later, he learned she did that whenever she was angry. It was a private understanding between the two of them. When Josiah or old Grandma or Robert was there, the agreement was suspended, and she pretended to treat him the same as she treated Rocky. But they both knew it was only temporary. When she was alone with the boys, she kept Rocky close to her. While she kneaded the bread, she gave Rocky little pieces of dough to play with. While she darned socks, she gave him scraps of cloth and a needle and thread to play with. She was careful that Rocky didn't share these things with Teo, that they kept the distance between themselves and him. But she wouldn't let Teo go outside or play in another room alone. She wanted him close enough to feel excluded, to be aware of the distance between them. The two little boys accepted the distance, but Rocky was never cruel to Teo. He seemed to know that the narrow silence was reserved only for times when the three of them were alone together. They sensed the difference in her when old Grandma or Josiah was present, and they adjusted without hesitation, keeping their secret. But after they started school, the edges of the distance softened, and Auntie seldom had the boys to herself anymore. They were gone most of the day, and old Grandma was totally blind by then and always there, sitting close to her stove. Rocky was more anxious than Teo to stay away from the house, to stay after school for sports or to play with friends. It was Rocky who withdrew from her, although only she and Teo realized it. He did it naturally, like a rabbit leaping away from a shadow suddenly above him. Teo and Auntie understood each other very well. Years later, Teo wondered if anyone, even old Grandma or Josiah, ever understood her as well as he did. He learned to listen to the undertones of her voice. Robert and Josiah evaded her. They were deaf to those undertones. In her blindness and old age, old Grandma stubbornly ignored her and heard only what she wanted to hear. Rocky had his own way with his after-school sports and his girlfriends. Only Teo could hear it, like fingernails scratching against bare rock, her terror at being trapped in one of the oldest ways. An old sensitivity had descended in her, surviving thousands of years from the oldest times, when the people shared a single clan name and they told each other who they were. They recounted the actions and words each of their clan had taken and would take. From before they were born and long after they died, the people shared the same consciousness. The people had known, with the simple certainty of the world they saw, how everything should be. But the fifth world had become entangled with European names. The names of the rivers, the hills, the names of the animals and plants, all of creation suddenly had two names, an Indian name and a white name. Christianity separated the people from themselves. It tried to crush the single clan name, encouraging each person to stand alone, because Jesus Christ would save only the individual soul. Jesus Christ wasn't like the mother who loved and cared for them as her children, as her family. The sensitivity remained, the ability to feel what the others were feeling in the belly and chest. Words weren't necessary, but the messages the people felt were confused now. When little sister had started drinking wine and riding in cars with white men and Mexicans, the people couldn't define their feelings about her. The Catholic priest shook his finger at the drunkenness and lust, but the people felt something deeper. They were losing her. They were losing part of themselves. The older sister had to act. She had to act for the people to get this young girl back. It might have been possible if the girl hadn't been ashamed of herself, shamed by what they taught her in school about the deplorable ways of the Indian people. Holy missionary white people who wanted only good for the Indians. White people who dedicated their lives to helping the Indians. These people urged her to break away from her home. She was excited to see that despite the fact she was an Indian, the white men smiled at her from their cars as she walked from the bus stop in Albuquerque back to the Indian school. She smiled and waved. She looked at her own reflection in windows of houses she passed. Her dress, her lipstick, her hair. It was all done perfectly, the way the home ec teacher taught them, exactly like the white girls. But after she had been with them, she could feel the truth in their fists and in their greedy, feeble lovemaking. But it was a truth which she had no English words for. She hated the people at home when white people talked about their peculiarities, but she always hated herself more, because she still thought about them, because she knew their pain at what she was doing with her life. The feelings of shame at her own people and at the white people grew inside her, side by side, like monstrous twins that would have to be left in the hills to die. The people wanted her back. Her older sister must bring her back. For the people, it was that simple. And when they failed, The humiliation fell on all of them. What happened to the girl didn't happen to her alone. It happened to all of them. They focused the anger on the girl and her family, knowing from many years of this conflict that the anger couldn't be contained by a single person or family, but that it must leak out and soak into the ground under the entire village. So Auntie had tried desperately to reconcile the family with the people. The old instinct had always been to gather the feelings and opinions that were scattered through the village, to gather them like willow twigs and tie them into a single prayer bundle that would bring peace to all of them. But now the feelings were twisted, tangled roots, and all the names for the source of this growth were buried under English words, out of reach. And there would be no peace, and the people would have no rest until the entanglement had been unwound to the source. He could anticipate her mood by watching her face. She had a special look she gave him when she wanted to talk to him alone. He never forgot the strange excitement he felt when she looked at him that way and called him aside. "Nobody will ever tell you this," she said, "but you must hear it so you'll understand why things are this way." She was referring to the distance she kept between him and herself. "Your uncle and grandma don't know this story. I couldn't tell them because it had hurt them so much." She swallowed hard to clear the pain from her throat. And his own throat hurt, too, because without him, there would have been not so much shame and disgrace for the family. "Poor old Grandma. It would hurt her so much if she ever heard this story." She looked at Teo and picked a thread off the bottom of her apron. Her mouth was small and tight when she talked to him alone. He sat on a gunny sack full of the corn that Robert and Josiah had dried last year, and when he shifted his weight even slightly, he could hear the hard kernels move. The room was always cool, even in the summertime, and it smelled like the dried apples and flour sack hanging above them from the rafters. That day he could smell the pale, almost blue clay the old women used for plastering the walls. "One morning," she said, "before you were born, I got up to go outside right before sunrise. I knew she'd been out all night because I'd never heard her come in. Anyway, I thought I'd walk down toward the river. Just had a feeling, you know. I stood on that sand rock above the big curve in the river, and there she was, coming down the trail on the other side." She looked at him closely. "I'm only telling you this because she was your mother and you have to understand." She cleared her throat. "Right as the sun came up, she walked under that big cottonwood tree, and I could see her clearly. She had no clothes on. Nothing. She was completely naked except for her high-heeled shoes. She dropped her purse under that tree. Later on, some kids found it there and brought it back. It was empty except for a lipstick." Theo swallowed and took a breath. "Auntie," he said softly, "what did she look like before I was born?" She reached behind the pantry curtains and began to rearrange the jars of peaches and apricots on the shelves, and he knew she was finished talking to him. He closed the storeroom door behind him and went to the back room and sat on the bed. He sat for a long time and thought about his mother. There had been a picture of her once, and he had carried the tin frame to bed with him at night and whispered to it. But one evening, when he carried it with him, there were visitors in the kitchen, and she grabbed it away from him. He cried for it, and Josiah came to comfort him. He asked Teo why he was crying, but just as he was ashamed to tell Josiah about the understanding between him and Auntie, he also couldn't tell him about the picture. He loved Josiah too much to admit the shame, so he held onto Josiah tightly and pressed his face into the flannel shirt and smelled wood smoke and sheep's wool and sweat. He even forgot about the picture, except sometimes when he tried to remember how she looked. Then he wished Auntie would give it back to him to keep on top of Josiah's dresser, but he could never bring himself to ask her. That day in the storeroom, when he asked how his mother had looked before he was born, was the closest he'd ever come to mentioning the picture. "So that's where our mother went. How can we get down there?" Hummingbird looked at all the skinny people. He felt sorry for them. He said, "You need a messenger. Listen, I'll tell you what to do. Bring a beautiful pottery jar, painted with parrots and big flowers. Mix black mountain dirt, some sweet corn flour, and a little water. Cover the jar with a new buckskin and say this over the jar, and sing this softly above the jar. After 4 days, you will be alive. After 4 days, you will be alive. After 4 days, you will be alive. After 4 days, you will be alive." The army recruiter looked closely at Teo's light brown skin and his hazel eyes. "You guys are brothers?" Rocky nodded coolly. "If you say so," the recruiter said. It was beginning to get dark, and he wanted to get back to Albuquerque. Teo signed his name after Rocky. He felt light on his feet, happy that he would be with Rocky, traveling the world in the army, together as brothers. Rocky patted him on the back, smiling too. "We can do real good, Teo. Go all over the world, see different places and different people. Look at that guy, the recruiter. He's got his own government car to drive, too." But when he saw the house and Josiah's pickup parked in the yard, he remembered. The understanding had always been that Rocky would be the one to leave home, go to college, or join the army. But someone had to stay and help out with the garden and sheep camp. He had made a promise to Josiah to help with the Mexican cattle. He stopped. Rocky asked him what was wrong. "I can't go," he said. "I told Josiah I'd stay and help him. Him and Robert can get along." "No," Teo said, feeling the hollow spread from his stomach to his chest, his heart echoing in his ears. "No." Rocky walked on without him. Teo stood there watching the darkness descend. He was familiar with that hollow feeling. He remembered it from the nights after they had buried his mother, when he stuffed the bed covers around his stomach and close to his heart, hugging the blankets into the empty space of loss, regret for things which couldn't be changed. "Let him go," Josiah said. "You can't keep him forever." Auntie let the lid on the frying pan clatter on top of the stove. "Rocky is different," she kept saying. "But this one, he's supposed to stay here." "Let him go," old Grandma said. "They can look after each other and bring each other home again." Rocky dunked his tortilla in the chili beans and kept chewing. He didn't care what they said. He was already thinking of the years ahead and the new places and people that were waiting for him in the future he had lived for since he first began to believe in the word someday, the way white people do. "I'll bring him back safe," Teo said softly to her the night before they left. "You don't have to worry." She looked up from her Bible, and he could see that she was waiting for something to happen. But he knew that she always hoped, that she always expected it to happen to him, not to Rocky. Part of the $500 deal was that Ulibarri would deliver the cattle. Teo helped Josiah separate the best ones from the rest of the herd. Josiah had borrowed Ulibarri's big Palomino horse, the one Ulibarri claimed was a brother to the champion cutting horse at the state fair. Whenever Josiah cut a cow away from the rest of the herd, Teo swung the gate open wide and stepped back to let it run into the holding pen. Josiah cut out 20 cows. He looked for the youngest and strongest ones. He didn't want Ulibarri to try anything funny, like substituting a crippled cow for a sound one, or sending one with runny eyes. So before they left, they walked around the pen slowly, memorizing each cow, the shape of the long curved horns, the patterns of the brown spots on their ivory hides, their size and weight. The last thing Josiah did was lean out the window of the truck and tell Ulibarri, "Don't starve them to death." All the way home from Magdalena, Josiah pulled at the short hairs in the little mustache he wore drooping down at the corners of his mouth, always at odds with his mouth because Josiah was always smiling. He looked over at Teo and grinned. "I'm thinking about those cattle, Teo. See, things work out funny sometimes. Cattle prices are way down now because of the dry spell. Everybody's afraid to buy. But see, this gives us the chance. Otherwise, we probably never would get into the cattle business." The sun was shining in the back window of the truck, and Teo had the window rolled down and his arm hanging out, feeling the air rush past. He felt proud when Josiah talked about cattle business. He was ready to work hard with his uncle. They had already discussed it. He was graduating in a month, and then he would work with Josiah and Robert. They would breed these cattle, special cattle, not the weak, soft Herefords that grew thin and died from eating thistle and burned off cactus during the drought. The cattle Ulubari sold them were exactly what they had been thinking about. These cattle were descendants of generations of desert cattle, born in dry sand and scrubby mesquite, where they hunted water the way desert antelope did. Cattle are like any living thing. If you separate them from the land for too long, keep them in barns and corrals, they lose something. Their stomachs get to where they can only eat rolled oats and dry alfalfa. When you turn them loose again, they go running all over. They're scared because the land is unfamiliar and they're lost. They don't stop being scared either, even when they look quiet and they quit running. Scared animals die off easily. They were driving down the gravel road and going east from Magdalena to catch the highway near Socorro. Teo was used to him talking like that, going over his ideas and plans out loud and then asking Teo what he thought. "See, I'm not going to make the mistake other guys made buying those Hereford white-faced cattle. If it's going to be a drought these next few years, then we need some special breed of cattle." He had a stack of books on the floor beside his bed with his reading glasses sitting on top. Every night, for a few minutes after he got in bed, he'd read about cattle breeding in the books the extension agent had loaned to him. Scientific cattle breeding was very complicated, he said, and he used to wait until Rocky and Teo were doing their homework on the kitchen table, and then he would come in from the back room with his glasses on, carrying a book. "Read this," he would tell Rocky, "and see if you think it's saying the same thing I think it says." When Rocky finished it, Josiah pushed the book in front of Teo and pointed at the passage. Then he'd say, "Well?" And the boys would tell him what they got out of it. "That's what I thought too," Josiah would say. "But it seemed like such a stupid idea, wasn't sure if I was understanding it right." The problem was the books were written by white people who didn't think about drought or winter blizzards or dry thistles, which the cattle had to live with. When Teo saw Ulubari's cattle, he thought of the diagram of the ideal beef cow which had been in the back of one of the books, and these cattle were everything that the ideal cow wasn't. They were tall and had long, thin legs like deer. Their heads were long and angular, with heavy bone across the eyes supporting wide, sharp horns which curved out over the shoulders. Their eyes were big and wild. "I guess we'll have to get along without these books," he said. "We'll have to do things our own way. Maybe we'll even write our own book, Cattle Raising on Indian Land, How to Raise Cattle That Don't Eat Grass or Drink Water." Teo and Robert laughed with him, but Rocky was quiet. He looked up from his books. "Those books are written by scientists. They know everything there is to know about beef cattle. That's the trouble with the way people around here have always done things. They never knew what they were doing." He went back to reading his book. He didn't hesitate to speak like that to his father and his uncle, because the subject was books and scientific knowledge, those things that Rocky had learned to believe in. Teo was suddenly sad, because what Rocky said was true. What did they know about raising cattle? They weren't scientists. Auntie had been listening, but she didn't seem to notice Rocky's disrespect. She valued Rocky's growing understanding of the outside world, of the books, of everything of importance and power. He was becoming what she had always wanted. Someone who could not only make sense of the outside world, but become part of it. She didn't like the cattle business, and she was pleased to have a scientific reason for the way she felt. This cattle deal was bound to be no good. because Ulibarri was a cousin to that whore. She was almost certain it was that woman who had been talking to Josiah, telling him things which weren't true, things which didn't agree with the scientific books that the BIA extension man had loaned them. But it was his money, and if that's what he wanted to do with 20 years of money he saved up, then let him make a fool of himself. I think it was some kind of trick, she told Rocky and Teo one evening when old Grandma was snoring in her chair. Auntie glanced over at her to be sure she was asleep before she said it. That dirty Mexican woman did it so Ulibarri could get rid of those worthless cattle. They gypped him. They made an old fool out of him. Rocky didn't hear her. He was reading a sports magazine. But Teo had heard. He always listened to her, and now his stomach felt tense. He was afraid maybe she was right, because he already knew she was right about some things. One thing after another all the time. She looked at Teo, and he turned away and stared at old Grandma. Her mouth hung open a little when she slept, and occasionally he could hear a snoring sound. Well, she said with a big sigh, it'll give him something else to laugh about. Rocky didn't say anything, but when he turned the page, he looked up at her as though he were tired of the sound of her voice. Teo knew that what village people thought didn't matter to Rocky anymore. He was already planning where he would go after high school. He was already talking about the places he would live, and the reservation wasn't one of them. Auntie got out her black church shoes and wiped them carefully with a clean, damp cloth, putting her finger inside the cloth and cleaning around each of the eyelets where the laces were strung. She examined them closely by the lamp on the table to make sure that any dust or spots of dirt left from last Sunday had been removed. She had gone to church alone for as long as Teo could remember. Although she told him that she prayed they would be baptized, she never asked any of them, not even Rocky, to go with her. Later on, Teo wondered if she liked it that way, going to church by herself, where she could show the people that she was a devout Christian and not immoral or pagan like the rest of the family. When it came to saving her own soul, she wanted to be careful that there were no mistakes. Old Grandma woke up. She asked Auntie what she was doing. She asked Teo and then Rocky. Auntie had to speak to Rocky because he didn't hear old Grandma the first time when she asked him what he was doing. Then old Grandma straightened up in her chair. Church, she said, wiping her eyes with a Kleenex from her apron pocket. Oh, Thelma, do you have to go there again? They unloaded the cows one by one, looking them over carefully. The cattle seemed thinner than the week before in Magdalena, but as Josiah said, you couldn't expect Ulibarri to feed someone else's stock. Teo swung open the big gate to the cattle chute, and Robert opened the door in the truck. They bolted down the ramp nimbly, and as each cow saw the open gate ahead, she lowered her head and snorted, racing out the opening. They kept running, and they didn't stop to look back at the big truck or the corrals until they were a quarter mile away. They bunched up, wary and skittish. When the last cow had run into the little herd, they stood for a moment, staring at the windmills and corrals and at the men beside the truck. Then they took off, heading south in a steady traveling gait. Teo watched them disappear over the horizon, their ivory hides shining, speckled brown like a butterfly's wing. They are really beautiful, aren't they? Josiah said. Teo nodded. The truck driver slammed the door and started the diesel engine. Robert joined them. Well, Josiah said. Well, how far will they run? Robert was smiling. I haven't seen anything so fast since the horse races at the state fair. They had unloaded them on the Cedillo Grant because the grass was still good down there. Josiah wanted to give them a good start because they would be calving later on. But a week later, when they went to check on the cattle, they didn't find them around the windmill where they had unloaded them. Ordinary cattle would have stayed near the water unless there had been rain or many other places for water. Josiah stopped the truck and got out. He pulled his leather work gloves from his hip pocket and put them on. Teo untied the horses and opened the gate on the stock rack. He backed the big sorrel out first. They rode south with the sun climbing up in the east, making the sky bright, almost blinding. There were no clouds, and the air still smelled cool. He wanted to remember the morning, bright and clear as the leaves on the little green plants which grew low and close to the sandy ground. It had the clarity of the sky after a summer rainstorm, when the dust was washed away, and the colors of the hills and the shadows of the mesas had an intensity which made everything he saw accessible, as if he could touch all of it, even the little green rabbit weed growing close to the sand, its tiny leaves clustered like stars. He looked over at Josiah. He was blowing little puffs of smoke from the thin cigarette he had rolled. He looked very satisfied, too, as if he were satisfied with everything that morning, even that his cattle had wandered away. He was thinking about something. Probably the cattle. They'd left the windmill, so they would have to travel until they found more water. Herefords wouldn't look for water. When a windmill broke down or a pool went dry, Teo had seen them standing and waiting patiently for the truck or wagon loaded with water, or for riders to herd them to water. If nobody came and there was no snow or rain, then they died there, still waiting. But these Mexican cattle were different. Josiah grinned at Teo and nodded. Teo smiled and nodded back at him. When they got to the Cedillo fence, they dismounted and walked along a 30-foot section where the tracks crisscrossed and the cattle had milled around before they broke through the fence. There were tufts of hair snagged in the barbs of wire, and in some places a strand of wire had been pulled loose from a fence pole and was hanging slack like an old clothesline. "Well, I guess we have to expect this, too," he said, pulling some of the hairs loose from the wire and letting them blow away in the wind. "What if they just keep going, you know, crossing fences all the way back to Mexico?" "They'd try that the first 2 or 3 days after you move them, but they'll settle down. We can handle them, Teo." The Mexican cattle settled down and moved more slowly, but they still had little regard for fences. They watered and grazed at the Cañoncito windmill for a few days before they started traveling again. It was simple to keep track of them because they were always moving south. By the end of May, they were all the way to the flats by Fernando's place, but they still ran if the men on horseback tried to get close. If they were pushed into a corner where fences intersected, they lunged through the wire without hesitation and trotted away to a safe distance, where they stood in a semicircle to watch the horsemen. They hadn't bothered to brand the cattle because they had a bill of sale which acknowledged their Mexican brands. But when they saw how the cattle kept moving, Josiah got worried and decided to brand them in case they got off reservation land. So in the middle of June, Teo and Rocky and Robert went to help Josiah with his cows. It took almost the entire day to round them up because they were so wild. As Robert said, it was okay as long as they were in flat, open country with only a few places to water. They could be found then, but he would hate to see them get up into the hills and the thick junipers and piñones where they could hide. "You'll never get them then, except with a 30-30, Robert said, and Josiah nodded. There were 3 calves born when they corralled them, and 2 of the cows looked as if they would calve within a few days. The little calves reminded Teo of new shoes, bright white with light brown speckles, silky and untouched by mud and sand. It was difficult to see how these calves would grow according to Josiah's theories. They were the same color as their mothers, and they had the same wild eyes, but Robert had to admit that the calves were stocky through the shoulder and hip, showing at least some trace of the fine registered Hereford bull that Ulibarri had insisted and sworn was their sire. They still ran like antelope in the big corral, bawling to escape the men with ropes, but Josiah said they would grow up heavy and covered with meat like Herefords, but tough, too, like the Mexican cows, able to withstand hard winters and many dry years. That was his plan. It was a good day when they branded them. Big, fluffy clouds that were high on the west horizon in the morning were dark blue and low by the afternoon. and a sudden rain shower came and washed down the dust of the corral and the sweat from the work. The cows already had big Mexican brands on their sides, extending across their ribs. A brand so big you could see it for a half a mile, Josiah said. And Robert nodded and added, "That's about as close as you can get to them anyway." The brand wasn't like American brands, which were initials or letters or even numbers. It looked like a big butterfly with its wings outstretched, or two loops of rope tied together in the center. They added Auntie's brand, a rafter four on the left shoulder of the cows and calves, and let them go. They galloped away, kicking up red clay dust. They were still going south. Josiah went to see her the day after the cattle were delivered. He talked to Teo in a low, confidential tone and told him not to let Auntie or old Grandma find out. They were outside of the woodpile, each with an arm full of kindling, but he whispered to Teo as if Auntie were only a few feet away from them. He straightened up and glanced over Teo's head at the sun, which was almost down, and spoke in a more natural tone. "Anyway," he said casually, "I'm only going up there to thank her again for letting me in on a good deal." He changed his shirt and put on a stiff new pair of Levi's and wiped off his $50 boots with the towel that was still damp from drying his arms and face. He told Teo to get the sharp scissors out of Auntie's sewing basket, and he trimmed the hairs in his thin mustache. Teo followed him outside into the cool, dim evening. Josiah looked at his own reflection in the truck window, stroking the hairs of his mustache into place. He made Teo promise to tell Auntie and Grandma that he had gone to Powati on business. Teo nodded, but he figured they already knew where Josiah was going anyway. She was sitting in the shade on her wicker chair. Her eyes were closed, and her face was relaxed. He liked to look at the way her light brown skin had wrinkled at the corners of her eyes and her mouth. From too much laughing, she liked to say. She knew he was standing there because the stairs up to the second-floor porch were loose and squeaked. "Sit down," she said without opening her eyes. "Enjoy the springtime with me." He liked the way she talked. There was something in her eyes, too. He saw it the first time when she had said, "I've seen you before many times, and I always remembered you." Josiah couldn't remember ever seeing her before, but there was something in her hazel-brown eyes that made him believe her. He sat on the straight-backed chair beside her and looked over at the big cottonwood that grew next to the porch, its branches sweeping and wide, hiding a portion of the northeast sky. On the fourth day, something buzzed around inside the jar. They lifted the buckskin, and a big green fly with yellow feelers on his head flew out of the jar. "Fly will go with me," Hummingbird said. "We'll go see what she wants." They flew to the fourth world below. Down there was another kind of daylight. Everything was blooming and growing. Everything was so beautiful. The hot weather and the fact that Lalo had always bootlegged beer to the Lagunas and Acomas brought him there one day when she was sitting in the shade of the porch outside the bar. She spoke first, asking if he had a cigarette paper. Josiah was surprised that a Mexican woman had spoken to him, and he gave her the paper without looking at her face. He stared at the sack of Bull Durham in her lap and watched the way she rolled the cigarette without spilling any tobacco. He was suddenly aware that she was watching him, and he mumbled something about it being a hot day and then left with his paper sack full of cold beer. But the rest of the afternoon and that night, too, he had an uncomfortable feeling that he had forgotten or lost something at Lalo's. After supper, he went out to make sure his work gloves were on the seat of the truck. He reached into his pocket and counted the money to make sure Lalo had given him the right change. He didn't sleep well that night either, and even while he dreamed, he was still aware of this feeling that something had been left behind. So the next day he went back to Cubero. It wasn't until he drove past the Cubero store and found himself looking to see if she was sitting on the porch that he realized his heart was beating like a boy's, and it was too late. He knew then what it was he had left behind. She looked up and smiled as if she had been waiting for him. She got up from her chair as he came up the steps and gestured at the bright sun and cloudless sky. "It's too hot down here," she said, walking to the stairs at the end of the long porch. He didn't say anything. He just followed her up the spiral stairs. "Some things I don't remember too well," she said. "Names of the places, names of the people, or even their faces. These small towns like El Paso and Socorro were full of people passing through the way I was. I danced. That was all that was important." She got up from the bed and disappeared through the curtains across the doorway. Josiah heard her cranking the Victrola. The needle scratched over the flamenco music. She brought out the shoes from a trunk under the bed. They had been wrapped carefully in white tissue paper, shiny black leather with high square heels. She hitched the blue silk dress higher on her wide hips and held the edges of the fabric in both hands as she arched her back and tossed her head. At first, all he was aware of were the heels of the shoes beating rapidly against the floor, and he wondered if Lalo and the afternoon customers in the bar downstairs could hear it. But as the music gathered speed, he forgot about how she made the room shake, because the spinning and tossing of her body and the momentum of the music had gathered him close, and he found himself breathing hard and sweating when the Victrola finally ran down. She sat back down on the bed beside him and wiped the shoes on the hem of the blue dress before she wrapped them up again and put them back in the trunk. "They called me the Night Swan," she said. "I remember every time I have danced." If she hadn't been so young, she would have realized that he was nothing, that the power she was feeling had always been inside her, growing, pushing to the surface, only its season coinciding with her new lover. But she was young, and she had never felt the power of the dance so strongly before, and she wanted to keep it. She wanted it with a great ferocity which she mistook for passion for this man. She was certain about him. He couldn't get enough of her. He would lie beside her under the blanket, and his eyes would be fevered even after he was limp and incapable of taking any more from her. She kept him there for as long as she could, searching out the boundary, the end to the power of the feeling. She wanted to prowl those warm, close places until she discovered the end, because at that time she hadn't yet seen that the horizon was an illusion, and the plains extended infinitely. And up until that final evening, she had found no limit. She knew it before he spoke. His eyes were still feverish as he spoke, and his fingers quivered like the legs of a dreaming dog. At that moment, he wanted her more than he had ever wanted her. And it was for that she wouldn't forgive him. She could have accepted it if he had told her that her light brown belly no longer excited him. She would have sensed it herself and told him to go. But he was quitting because his desire for her had uncovered something which had been hiding inside him. Something with wings that could fly, escape the gravity of the church, the town, his mother, his wife. So he wanted to kill it, to crush the skull into the feathers and snap the bones of the wings. "Whore! Witch! Look at what you made me do to my family and my wife!" "You came breathlessly," she answered in a steady voice. "But you will always prefer the lie. You will repeat it to your wife. You will repeat it at confession. You damn your own soul better than I ever could." He grabbed her shoulders. His mouth was twisted open and the breath was hot and short. But it was his own body, not hers, which shook. Then his hands went limp and fell with their own weight from her shoulders. "We will run you out of town," he said. "People listen to me. I'm somebody in this town." That night she danced, he was already a dead man, a living dead man who sucked life from the living, desiring and hating it even as he took it. The ecstasy he found in her had illuminated the dead tissues and outlined the hollow of his spirit. She danced, spinning her body, pulling her thighs and hips into tight, sudden motions, bending, sweeping, veering, and lunging, whirling until she was the bull and at the same time the killer, holding out her full skirts like a cape. The men sitting around the tables at the edge of the dance floor pushed themselves away, some stumbling over chairs, spilling their beer in a panic that pounded in their chests like her heels against the floor. The bartender left a towel stuffed in the glass he had been wiping, but they watched, pressing close to one another, shivering in the farthest corner of the bar. They watched her. And when the guitar player finally laid his instrument on the floor and held his head between his hands, she danced on. I knew nothing of minutes or hours. There were changes I could feel. The boards of the dance floor began to flex and glisten. The creaking of the wood became a moan and a cry. My balance was precarious, as if the floor were no longer level. And then I could feel something breaking under my feet, the heels of my dancing shoes sinking into something crushed dark, until the balance and smoothness were restored once again to the dance floor. She looked up at Josiah and pulled at a blue thread hanging from the sleeve of her dress. His wife came into the bar screaming. The damp cold of the snowstorm wind followed her through the door she had thrown open wide. Memory is strange. I don't remember her face or her name, but I remember her feet. There was new snow on her bare feet where she had run from her house to the cantina. They were pale and small on the dark, oiled wood floor. I watched the snow melt into little streams between her toes while she accused me. She paused and rolled herself another thin cigarette. There had been some kind of accident with his horses late that night, she said as she lighted it, inhaling deep and shaking her head slowly. His screaming woke her up. She ran into the snow like that, nightgown and bare feet, and found him in the corral. His own horses had trampled him. That was all. Her hazel eyes were shining. She smiled at Josiah. Who listens to the stories wives tell? She squeezed his arm. But all that was a long time ago. I don't even remember how many years ago that happened in Las Cruces. She poured him more beer in a thick pottery cup with yellow flowers painted around it. I'm a grandmother now. My daughter in Los Angeles has two beautiful little daughters. And when I dance now, I dance for them. She moved closer to him on the bed. One day I got up and walked down the main street of Socorro. The wind was blowing dust down the little side streets, and I felt like I was the only one living there anymore. The drought was drying out the land, stealing away the river, so that even the cottonwoods and tamaracks along the banks were drying up. I had a feeling then. Something inside me beginning to shrink thin and dry, like old newspapers gone yellow in the bottom of a trunk. I rode the bus this far. I saw the mountain, and I liked the view from here. She nodded in the direction of the mountain Tsepina, the woman veiled in clouds. She shook her head slowly and emptied the last of the beer into her cup. Old age, she said, laughing. The first sign of old age is all this talking, when we could be doing something else. She winked at him, and Josiah pulled her close, promising himself he would never ask her what it was about the mountain that caused her to stop there. At first, the Cubero people were upset about the Night Swan's choice of a retirement place. Lalo was sullen when anyone asked, and he said it was his wife who had rented her the rooms above the bar. He always added that they were old and dusty, and no one else would live up there because the jukebox played loud, and drunks yelled and stomped up and down the long porch downstairs. Of course, only that kind of woman, used to that kind of life, would tolerate such things. After she moved in, people said the steps on the spiral staircase at the end of the porch were never dusty anymore. But that was only rumor. and there were conflicting stories about where she got her money. But the facts remained. She was an old cantina dancer with eyes like a cat. The women watched the bright blue door on the second-story porch, and they imagined unspeakable scenes between the night swan and their husbands or sons. When Josiah started coming to see her, and his blue GMC truck was parked there every evening until midnight, the Cubero women relaxed. They could even laugh a little. "She's so old and wrinkled," they whispered, "all worn out. Only some old Indian would want her anyway." But still they watched every evening to make sure his truck was there, as if they knew the sensation in the groin of their husbands each time the men passed Lalo's and saw the bright blue door. "That's what all the rumors say," Auntie hissed at Teo in the storeroom where she had cornered him. "I was the last one to know what my own brother has been doing. Why didn't you tell me?"
"Because I didn't know for sure."
"Liars and fools," she said, rearranging the mason jars full of peaches on the shelf, pushing them hard against each other until he thought the glass might break. "I've spent all my life defending this family, but nobody ever stops to think what the people will say, or that Father Kenneth will call me aside after Mass to speak with me." She straightened herself as tall as she could, because she was short and heavy-set. Her eyes were full of accusations. "It doesn't bother me," she said, assuming a lighter tone of voice. "But this hurts old Grandma so much." Her words were shaky. "Our family, old Grandma's family, was so highly regarded at one time. She's used to being respected by people." She stopped pushing the mason jars around and began dusting off the table where the old shopping bags were folded and stacked. "Young people don't understand how important it is to be able to walk through the village without worrying or wondering what the people are whispering about you." She wiped tears from the corners of her eyes with the hem of her apron and walked out of the storeroom. She slammed the door behind her fiercely. Teo always wondered how she knew that people were whispering about her as she walked out of the church. He wondered, too, if Auntie was lying, or if she really didn't realize that old Grandma didn't care what anyone said. She liked to sit by her stove and gossip about the people who were talking about their family.
"I know a better one than that about her. That woman shouldn't dare be talking about us. What about the time they found her rolling around in the weeds with that deaf man from Encinal? What about that? Everyone remembers it."
She pounded her cane on the floor in triumph. The story was all that counted. If she had a better one about them, then it didn't matter what they said. "I've been thinking," the night swan said to Josiah one evening when they were sitting in her room. She was sitting on the edge of the bed looking into the mirror, and he was sitting on the old blue armchair in the corner.
"All these years you've done the same things," she said.
He smiled and shrugged his shoulders.
"That's how I've lived so long, up until now."
She laughed at his reference to her.
"My cousin Ulibarri in Magdalena wrote," she said. "He's selling some Mexican cattle very cheap. They're off the desert in Sonora, and he said he thought someone up this way might want to buy them."
"I don't know," Josiah said. "Last time there was a drought, we had to sell everything, even the sheep and goats."
"I don't know anything about cattle," she said, "but he said these had been living off rocks and sand."
She laughed and went out to the kitchen to pour them some coffee.
"Why are you looking so serious?" she said as she handed him the cup.
"I'm thinking about the cattle business," he said.
By late July, Josiah divided his time between the cattle, which were past Flower Mountain then, still heading southwest, and this woman. Josiah didn't mention her much anymore, not since Auntie had cornered Teo in the storeroom. He said it was better this way. Teo wouldn't have to lie if he didn't know anything. Teo helped him, as he had promised, riding along the fence line between Acoma land and the Laguna land.
And they found tracks and sagging wires on the fences, with bits of light hair caught in the barbs. They rode through the Acoma gate and brought the cows back again. When they had finished with the cattle, it was always the sheep camp. Auntie insisted that they check on the sheep herder because she was certain that he would run off and leave the sheep penned up to slowly die of thirst. Or worse yet, that the sheep herder had got drunk and burned up the little sheep camp house. Even after they had driven over the bumps and washed out places on the sandy road and made sure that these things hadn't happened, she would be satisfied for only 2 or 3 days. Then she would be convinced that the sheep herder had lost all the sheep, and that he was too lazy to hunt for them, and that the sheep were wandering in the red rocks, where coyotes would pick them off 3 and 4 at a time. Teo wondered where she got these ideas, because they never happened. But when she talked about them, they sounded possible, not likely, but possible, so they had to go.